Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The Gist is sponsored by Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage right from your desk using your own computer and printer. Right now, get a no-risk trial and a $110 bonus offer by going to Stamps.com and using the promo code THEGIST. And by Squarespace, the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store. Squarespace features an easy-to-use interface, beautiful templates, and 24/7 customer support. Right now, go to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GIST at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
It's Wednesday, June 3rd, 2015. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. You know, I would cook if I just had the time, maybe a good recipe book, a little training. I'd like to. But in this regard, I am no better than the animals. Headline, New York Times, chimpanzees would cook if given the chance, research says. Here, reporter James Gorman explains chimpanzee preferences for cooked over raw food, as discovered by researchers.
The chimps preferred the food cooked. They were willing to hold off on eating the raw food and wait for the process of cooking. And they would even take the food from one side of the cage to the other to bring it to the device. This is the kind of cognitive foundation that human ancestors would have needed to start using fire and cooking.
So here's what the results found. I read the original experiment. The chimps have the brain power to figure out that cooked food tastes better, and then they employ a variety of strategies to get their food cooked, right? They'll put it in something they think is an oven, they'll save food for later, for when the oven's on, that sort of thing. Here's what the results really don't find. I'll quote the New York Times headline again, chimpanzees would cook if given the chance. Who is denying them this chance? The Telegraph, the UK Telegraph, through use of a very telling pronoun, provides the answer, provides the who. Here is the headline of their story. Chimps could cook if we gave them the chance. Yes, us. It's the hominid community aligning against the chimps. It's our fault. Opposable thumb privilege again. How guilty are we supposed to feel oppressing pan troglodytes? That's their Latin name. These things are troglodytes, denying them Viking stoves. Yeah, the research does not say that we are not giving them the chance to cook. Let me quote the research, all right? Chimpanzees possess this set of fundamental psychological capacities for cooking. Why do wild chimpanzees not actually cook their food? One obvious reason is that chimpanzees do not control fire, which limits their ability to cook food. Yes, yes, it does. Fire. There was a quest for fire. I saw that movie. There was a weird caveman humping scene. It scarred me a little bit as a kid. Anyway, chimps want cooked food. That doesn't mean they could cook food. That doesn't mean they would cook food if we weren't getting in their way. And even if they did cook food, what letter grade would our health inspectors possibly give them? If you get a C for cold food item held above 41 degrees Fahrenheit, imagine the score for feces liberally flung at wall. So chimps would cook if given the chance? Please, people. People who fail to see any of the Planet of the Apes movies, do not give them the chance. Civilization and your dinner tonight might depend on it. On the show today, I spiel about a famous document that is old, even older than Bernie Sanders' unfortunate writings about gender. But now, singer-songwriter, guitar player, record label owner Mac McCaughan stops by. He plays a song or two, and then he leaves early to eat in a chimpanzee-owned tapas joint. So we're going to pause now from Mac, and we're going to talk about Stamps.com. Hypothetical. Imagine. if the post office were open 24/7. You'd get your mailing and shipping done on your schedule, especially if you're a small business owner. Well, now you can when you use Stamps.com. It'll save you the time and hassle of going to the post office. You don't have to rush there during your busy day. You're running a business, right? You could use your computer and printer and get official U.S. postage for any letter or package, and the mailman will come and pick it up. You could save money with Stamps.com, too. Get exact postage the instant you need it. Even get special discounts when you can't get them at the post office. Right now, use the promo code THEGIST for a special offer, a no-risk trial. $110 bonus offer. It includes a digital scale and up to $55 free postage. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in the gist. That's Stamps.com, and enter the gist. Mac McCaughan is the impresario behind Merge Records, the front man for Superchunk. We could say he's the front man for Porta Static, but that was just him. He was really Porta Static. Come on. But now he's Mac McCaughan. His new album is Non-Believers. He's here with me. Hey, Mac.
How's it going?
First, I want to go to, you were a solo artist. You still are. But now you're what? Owning the fact that your name is Mac McCaughan and that's portmanteau of Static and the Porta Sound
recording system? I'm not hiding anymore.
You're not bright-eyesing it. You're not St. Vincenting it.
Nope.
What does that get you to come out?
I guess it takes 25 years.
Yeah.
And running out of other things to call myself.
But you basically figured you couldn't call yourself Porta Static if you weren't playing with those other guys?
Well, no. The Porta Static lineup was constantly changing.
Yeah.
But that started as a very specific thing to be an alternative to Superchunk at the time, so I could make a totally different kind of music as that, and it kind of served that purpose for a long time. But when I made this record, I don't know, like when it was done, I felt like to use the Porta Static name would be going back in time a little bit, and
yeah.
I just kind of wanted to move forward, and I've been enjoying doing solo shows under my own name. I play Superchunk songs, I play Porta Static songs, and so I figured, let's put out a record under that name and just know that no one will be able to pronounce it, though you did correctly, and no one will be able to spell it either.
So, is this album, and we're going to hear a song right off the bat and then talk more, but is the album confessional or in any way more personal? I mean, how much can we judge from the fact that it is actually a Mac McCaughan album?
That's a good question in that I feel like there's always something of you in the stuff that you're making, but it's not, I wouldn't say it's confessional, but I would say it's drawn from personal memories and experiences and friends I've had and what it was like to be 15 years old in 1982. Like that kind of world was a lot of what I was thinking about when I was writing the songs, as well as what it's like to have kids that will soon be teenagers or adolescents. And thinking about both of those things at once.
So we should say that the sound's going to come out of a really great amp supplied by Slate blogger Ben Mathis Lilly. But a lot of the sound on the album is, I mean, a lot of guitar, obviously, a great guitarist. More synthesizers than we have come to expect from some of your other stuff.
There are a lot of keyboards and synthesizers that I've kind of been accumulating since before I made the first Porta Static record. And to me, anytime you pick up a new instrument, whether it's just a different guitar than you normally play or something even more foreign to me, like a synthesizer, which I'm not a trained keyboard player, it makes you write different kinds of songs and gives you different ideas. And so one thing I love about making records and writing songs that I know aren't going to be Superchunk songs is that I can start with any instrument and it just kind of leads you down a road. And the first song on the record, Your Hologram, for instance, started with a keyboard line and a keyboard sound. And that determined that song and also kind of the tone of the rest of the record. And the song I'm going to play now, while it's a very guitar-heavy song on the record, kind of started with the idea of a drum machine, having the drum machine be the beat and then just kind of working from there. The song's called Box Batteries, and that started, again, with just a machine, and then working on top of that.
Fantastic. All right.
Get your stepdad's car. Let's take make it out to the cliffs. But we could start a fire. And you can pretend, yeah, you can pretend to be a witch. Tip money in the ashtray. Oh, it feels like we're rich. We've got box batteries and the cheapest beer there is. Hey! Dark, that's what we like. We don't go that far, no. Oh, but we might. We've got box batteries. See the smoke from the flagstones in the neighborhood rising up above your hair, and your hair looks good. We're not so into nature, oh, but we're deep into the woods. Bring your tapes and disaffection, and the rest is understood. The rest is understood. That's what we like. We don't go too far, no. Oh, but we might. Yeah, it's so dark. Tell the other kids we bite. We don't go that far, no. Oh, but we might. We've got box batteries. Box batteries. We've got box batteries.
All right. Nice. So what was the cheapest beer you could get in 1982 in Durham, North Carolina?
There was a beer called Max Beer.
No.
M-A-X-X.
Okay.
Not spelled like my name.
No.
It had a gold and red can, and it was like $1.99 a six-pack. Uh-huh.
And when you wrote that, that was the beer you were thinking of, the cheapest
yes.
beer you could?
Yes. Yeah.
So you mentioned, you know, the album is capturing the spirit of 1982, being 15, and this is a reason that a lot of the songs, I don't know if it's a reason, but sure, a lot of the songs are kind of new wavy, kind of post-punk, but of course, at that time in 1982, meant synthesizers. It necessarily meant synthesizers. It was a synthesizer moment.
Well, it was a synthesizer moment, which I think that as kind of rock fans and fans of punk rock bands and fans of bands like R.E.M., we certainly resisted the synthesizers to a certain extent, though there was a lot of exposure to it because, you know, MTV was the vehicle for bands becoming popular then, and so many of those bands were using synthesizers, and a lot of the bands that you heard on college radio as well. So while there was definitely some resistance, certain bands, New Order, for instance, kind of busted through that resistance, and I could resist no more.
Yeah, The Cure, were they one?
The Cure, again, like, you know, started out as a guitar band, but then they slowly started introducing the synthesizers, and they just made such interesting music and such, they wrote great songs. I mean, to me, I think that's what always kind of conquers is great songs. So even if at first you're thinking like, well, I don't like that fake whatever sound,
right.
You know, if the song itself kind of works its way into your brain, you're kind of done for.
But there's no one so curmudgeonly, so stuck in their ways as a 15-year-old impassioned about music. I mean, I remember saying, oh, Springsteen, yeah, but give me a break, this Prince. Come on, it's dance stuff. I was Springs right on the Springsteen, wrong on the Prince.
Right. No, I know what you mean. And it was interesting moving from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, where I was born and lived until I was 13, we moved to North Carolina. It was right in the heart of well, Prince was starting to get big. Hip-hop was huge, and in South Florida, classic rock was really the thing. You know, my first concert was Molly Hatchet.
Yeah.
And I loved Springsteen.
38 Special.
And
Lynyrd Skynyrd, yeah. These are Tallahassee and Northern Florida
exactly.
rock. Yeah.
And when we moved to Carolina, for instance, I was the statistician for the basketball team in junior high. So on the
bus, by the way, in the research triangle of North Carolina is basically a godlike position.
That basketball is huge. And on the bus to and from games, I mean, hip-hop was what they were listening to, and it was all new to me, and it took some getting used to. And, of course, now I love it, and, you know, those guys were, like, looking towards the future, whereas I was, like, you know, still listening to AC/DC, which I also love. But it wasn't, you know, one of the things that this record is about is transitional time periods in music, in your life, you know, in culture, and that was such a huge moment, and it's doubly huge if you happen to be at this impressionable age when it's all going on, when punk rock is turning into something else, hip-hop is starting to become popular, like you're saying, Prince, you know, like all these things were kind of mind-blowing, and to be at the age to have your mind blown was like, it was very exciting. And so while popular music is doing all that, simultaneously you're going to like, you get old enough to go to hardcore shows and, you know, hardcore matinees and things like that. It's just a lot. There's a lot going on, so I wasn't exactly trying to cover all that ground on the record, but those were the kind of things I was thinking about.
So do you write, are the songs written from the perspective of knowing that you're you now, looking back, a lot of past tense and were, or did you ever lyrically, I don't know if you could do this musically, but lyrically say something that you knew was, you know, knowingly false or a naive thing that a kid then would say that you
Both. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, I was kind of imagining a pair of kids, really, you know, that were not a romantic couple, but friends who were going through this time period together. Because one thing that's interesting to me when I think about that, and it could be a 14-year-old today, it's how fast everything changes, and you have these friendships and you have these relationships that are just born out of not being in the mainstream or not being in, like, you know, the popular group of kids at school or whatever. And so you kind of hunker down, whether it's with music or something else. And then 2 years later, people go off to college, people get jobs, and all of a sudden, you know, but in that moment, it feels like the most important thing is this relationship you have with this person or this relationship you have with this band or this record or whatever, you know. It's something that is always happening for someone, you know. So I was in some ways looking back and thinking about it from a remove, but also trying to put myself in that place of those people, you know.
All right, so these two characters that you wrote about, are they named in any of the songs? Do they become protagonists? Or are they just sort of...
No, I think that some of the songs just are looking at that kind of relationship from different angles.
Yeah.
And for instance, the song Box Batteries in some ways is a song that, you know, you listen to, for instance, if you're 15 and maybe you have an acoustic guitar, maybe you have an electric guitar, but you're still learning how to play it. If you hear a song by Duran Duran, you can't recreate that.
Right.
Your band is not going to sound like that. But you could record a song like Box Batteries. If you got a drum machine and you have an electric guitar, like, that's the kind of thing, you know, I was thinking, like, well, this is the kind of thing that, like, you could do on your own in your bedroom with your friends or whatever. So that's in some ways one of the things I was thinking about, and the fact that I'm still doing that, you know, in my basement.
I think rock music can do a lot of things, but what it really does best, and by the way, when we're young, we want it to do everything, but what it does best is convey an emotion. That's, I think, that's the fundamental thing of rock music, maybe even more than any other kind of music. And sometimes when you try to do more than that, I don't know, sometimes it works. Sometimes it becomes a prog rock visionary, and sometimes it's embarrassing.
One reason that I've never really liked talking about or getting super specific about what songs are, quote unquote, about, for one thing, I've never been great at writing songs that are just about one thing, you know. So it's hard to talk about. But also, if you never heard someone saying, this is what this song is about, you have your own idea.
Yeah.
And that's just as valid.
Yeah.
You know, if that, whatever you're getting out of it is just as valid or maybe more valid than when someone's saying, no, this is actually what you should be thinking about when you hear this song.
You know what? If Who'll Stop the Rain, if you think it's about stopping the rain, that's okay.
Yeah.
If it reminds you of a rainy day where that song played and it's nothing to do with Vietnam, that works.
Well, and, you know, listening to one of our favorite bands at this, you know, when we were in high school, for instance, R.E.M. I mean, you had no idea what an R.E.M. song was about.
Yeah.
But you loved the way the words sounded and the guitars and everything, and it was exciting, and it didn't matter really what it was.
Yeah.
Really about.
Birds and snakes and airplanes. I'll take it. Yeah. Mac McConn is the man. Non-Believers is, it turns out, the new album and also his backing group. He's on tour, and the album is out from Merge Records, his own label. Thank you, Mac.
Thanks for having me.
And guess what? I'm going to throw it at you now. Got a spiel to get to. But at the end of the show, Mac played another song for us, and we'll put it there. There's nothing more hilarious than technology that's out of date. I don't mean an anachronism, but if you want to set a time-traveling movie and you have a guy going back to the past, well, what you're going to want to do is put a character in parachute pants, but really have him futzing with a Betamax or a 2XL. The same with websites, right? So if you ever need to set a movie in the early 90s, have one of those crappy websites with a lot of blinky stuff, the song should be the MIDI version of Breaking My Stride. Let's say, you know, MIDI, it makes Casio seem like the world's greatest piano. So Squarespace makes your site look professionally designed, even if you're not a professional, even if you have no skill level. It takes the ball. It knows that you're trying to do what you're trying to do, either express your innermost thoughts about hippopotamuses or sell some cookware. You're not a website designer. You're the hippopotamus guy. Sorry, I'm not insulting you. I just mean that you love hippopotamuses. So Squarespace includes intuitive and easy-to-use tools. It has state-of-the-art technology powering your site to ensure security and stability. It's trusted by millions and some of the most respected brands in the world. It starts at $8 a month, and you get a free domain if you sign up for a year. So do start your free trial today with no credit card required at squarespace.com. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code GIST to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace. Build it, beautiful. See how I said that? I was trying to make you sound like the beautiful person because I insulted you about the hippo a second ago. Build it, beautiful. And now the spiel. Oh, sorry. It's just spiel. Breaking news. Well, actually, we're a little late. We're 800 years too late. It is the 800th anniversary. I'll say it. It's the octocentennial of the Magna Carta. June 15th is the date given for the Magna Carta's 800th signing, and now we're less than 2 weeks before the anniversary. And I'd like to tell you one thing I did not know about the Magna Carta. It's not the Magna Carta. Oh, it's great. It's a charter, but no the. No duh. No the. It's just Magna Carta. Why? Well, hear me out. According to standard British usage, it's simply referred to as Magna Carta without the definite article. The charter, Magna Carta, was written in Latin, in which there are no exact equivalents for an or the. But that doesn't mean we're always getting it right just because it's official, like the National Archives page on Magna Carta is titled The Magna Carta, and the National Archives Museum sells a children's book called The Magna Carta, Cornerstone of the Constitution. If you Google, quote, The Magna Carta, you see that Forbes gets it wrong, NPR gets it wrong, National Law Review gets it wrong in this article, why the Wall Street Journal is wrong about the Magna Carta. It's a trick! The Wall Street Journal wasn't wrong because it never said anything about The Magna Carta. Wall Street Journal got it right. The Wall Street Journal got it right. But lots of sources actually do get it right. English ones usually get it right. Of course, the New Yorker does. But also, here is Franklin Delano Roosevelt with a Magna Carta shout-out during his third inaugural.
The democratic aspiration is no mere recent phase in human history. It is human history. It permeated the ancient life of early peoples. It blazed anew in the Middle Ages. It was written in Magna Carta.
Way to go, FDR, and also way to go, Magna Carta. Anyone can be mentioned in a presidential inaugural, but not in a third presidential inaugural that only happened once. As for the document itself, no the, but some interesting words. Here's a quote. If any persons hold from us at fee farm or in sockage or burgage, Sockage and burgage. Sockage in feudal English property law is a form of land tenure in which the tenant lived on the lord's land and in return rendered to the lord a certain agricultural output. This was back when you say the lord, you actually meant the lord, not God. They were a little more explicit about that. By the way, total side note, if the Bible were written today, we'd call God the president, right? The good president. Anyway, burgage means a town, you know, a borough, rental property owned by a king or lord, not God, lord. Here's another quote. Knight service on the pretext of some small sergeanty held to us by service of rendering us knives or arrows or such like things. By tenure of sergeanty. Sergeanty was a form of land holding in return for some specified service. How do I know it's pronounced sergeanty? I researched it and did not stop on the first YouTube video that purported to tell me how to properly pronounce sergeanty. Listen to this thing.
Sergeanty.
All of those words, all of the words I've just said, would make for excellent album names for any band that features a mandolin and a glockenspiel. I mean, there is a band out there called You Bred Raptors, question mark. What the hell does that mean? Did they know that the option sockage and burgage was out there? That's a much better band name. Well, it is, you guys. Here's another phrase from the Magna Carta. Might not inspire band names. If a man dies owing money to Jews, his wife may have her dower and pay nothing toward the debt. A few references to Jews in there. They were the moneylenders. Here's another phrase. I give these to the bands again. All counties, hundred, wapentakes, or try-things shall remain at the old rents. Wapentakes, try-things. Think towns, forms of towns, boroughs, burghs, hamlets. I suppose I should mention some other things that the Magna Carta inspired codified law. It inspired checks and balances. It inspired government accountability. You know, you can make the case that inspired democracy, inspired Three Lil Wayne albums, the Magna Carta 1, the Magna Carta 2, the Magna Carta 3. Sorry, no the. But I'm more inspired by the latest LP it inspired. You love the first album, Waynage, and its follow-up, which went gold, Scuttage. But now, the singer-songwriter who records under the moniker Tenure by Sargenty is out with his first live effort. Accordingly, our wish and command, hear all the hits. The above-mentioned people. Should such a thing be procured, deprived, or dispossessed? And of course, the hauntingly original Arrows or the like. And hear covers of other famous songs. John Barleycorn Must Die by Traffic. Flowers in Your Hair by the Lumineers. The Decembrists' The Wanting Comes in Waves. And of course, Sisqó's The Thong Song. That's Tenure by Sargenty's new album, Live at Runnymede. While supplies last, people who live outside the forest need not in future appear before the royal justices of the forest and answer to general summonses unless they are actually involved in proceedings or sureties for someone who has been seized by a forest offense. Offer not good in Alaska and Hawaii. The Gist is produced. Yes, it actually is produced today by Andrea Salenzi, the returning champion. Her favorite ape cuisine is chicken chimpanzee. Joel Meyer, managing producer, enjoys a chimp mixed drink. It's a lager plus a Guinness plus orange fur, a black and orangutan. Share a growler with a howler. Andy Bowers will occasionally eat ape prepared seafood. He enjoys grilled chimp scampi. It's not made with chimps, it's made by chimps, was the slogan that did not move any product. But I'd like to move some tickets here because I'm promoting Mom and Dad Are Fighting, the live show. If you live near the Triangle region, if you don't know what the Triangle region is. It's, you know, Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, that area. Anyway, Dan Coyce and Allison Benedict, the host of the Panoply Podcast Network's Mom and Dad Are Fighting, will be there Sunday, June 7th at Motor Co. in Durham. And the evening special guest will be Mac McCon of Superchunk. He'll talk about indie rock dadhood and the new solo album Non-Believers. And I'm telling you, there won't be that much overlap with the conversation we have here. And if you're a Slate Plus member, you get a 30% discount on your ticket purchase. So that's Mom and Dad Are Fighting at Motor Co. in Durham, North Carolina, Sunday, June 7th. For tickets, go to slate.com/momanddadlive. And now, to close out our show, here's Mac again from the Slate Studios with an old Portastatic song, Noisy Night.
last July. Like a soaking sheet came down. Yeah, like a broken hose soaking the ground. But you were not around. Some of us held true to form. Well, in the summer, yeah, in the dog days, the attic gets warm. So we stayed in just to see the sweat in someone else's skin. Now it's a noisy, noisy night, and you can't hear the kissing for the fight. Ice in your jib, crickets on 10. Underneath the yellow bug light. Yeah, it's a noisy, noisy night, and you stumble towards the warmth of something bright. Ice down your chin, crickets on 10. Underneath the yellow bug light. And you feel the stiffness go out of this town. What will have changed? And who will engage these summer currents? Cause you know I'm down. Or will we drift out in the yard? Linger too long against the hood of your car and take that as enough to get us through. Well, it's tough. Now it's a noisy, noisy night, and you can't hear the kissing for the fight. I see your jib, crickets on 10. Underneath the yellow bug light. Yeah, it's a noisy, noisy night, and this whole town's got its mouth open wide. Ice down your chin. Well, who let these jokers in? Yeah, baby, let's just go for a ride. It's a noisy night.
Hey there, I'm Karina Kolodny.
And I'm Noah Michelson.
We're the co-hosts of the HuffPost Love and Sex podcast.
Each week, we start with a single question, and then we look to experts, real-life experiences, and listeners like you to find the answers.
Questions like, how can unleashing the power of the clitoris revolutionize the world?
Or, what is sex really like after 70?
In our May 21st episode, we explore open relationships and what you need to know if you're thinking of leaving monogamy behind.
So abandon your inhibitions and download and subscribe to the HuffPost Love and Sex podcast on iTunes and Stitcher.